use Regeneron and Lilly antibodies. If the NIH said, we understand the data, we can't be for it or against it. But at least we got a neutral statement out of them. Hydroxychloroquine still to this day has a series of negative statements on this. And doctors have literally had to fight for their medical licenses in order to prescribe hydroxychloroquine. One by one by one, all of those licenses have been restored. All of those state rulings have been overturned. All the medical societies have been overturned, and hydroxychloroquine is used today. Ivermectin is widely used today. Both drugs can not only treat the infection early, but they can prevent the infection. There's prophylactic studies. They can prevent, if patients take these drugs periodically, typically once a week or so, they can prevent COVID-19 from becoming an illness. They are preventive. In fact, I led one of the very early studies of hydroxychloroquine here in Dallas to protect our healthcare workers. These drugs are about 90% effective. They are about as effective as the vaccines in preventing acquiring COVID-19. When someone's ill, I never prescribe these drugs alone, but I prescribe them in what I call sequence multi-drug therapy. But that is the approach that independent doctors have taken in the United States, and uniquely, not a single academic medical center today or community medical center today treats COVID-19 patients as an outpatient with the goal of reducing hospitalizations and deaths. Why would these centers not want to help their patients? You know, doctors clearly have a groupthink. And doctors want intellectual support for what they do. That's the reason why we meet all the time. That's the reason why we go on rounds together. That's the reason why we have conferences every day. We want to intellectually support each other for making decisions on patients for the assurances we're making the right decisions. And what happened was with the pandemic, all of our meetings were dissolved. We could not meet with each other anymore. There wasn't a chance to have much intellectual support. And each doctor, one by one, had to make a decision. When the next patient called and said, listen, I'm sick with COVID-19, can you help me? There was a binary choice. The choice was, no, I'm not going to help you. Nothing works. There's nothing I can do. Just wait until you get hospitalized. Or the answer could be, you know what, let me try. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that binary choice was the biopsy of who really had courage and who really had excellent clinical judgment. And doctors who were not confident in their clinical judgment quickly said, you know what, there's nothing you can do. And they got into that groupthink. And that could have been 90% plus of doctors had a lack of clinical judgment and a lack of courage. And what I found in this whole thing is those two things are rare. And for me, it was just very natural. It was very natural. My father was one of the first nursing home COVID-19 patients in Dallas. He was the very first one at Presbyterian Village. He got COVID-19, had pelvic fracture. He's flat on his back. A scared PA says, your dad's got COVID. He's in a unit. We don't know what's going to happen. His mortality, being completely bedridden with dementia and now COVID, I can tell you he was facing an 80% mortality of just having COVID just ravage him. So what did I do? Did I make that binary decision of doing nothing? Of course not. Of course not. If I could ever message any American doctor or any doctor in the world right now, have some courage and trust your clinical judgment. I did, and that's what real doctors do. And I will never apologize for that. Of course, my dad was treated with hydroxychloroquine. He was treated with azithromycin. He was treated with aspirin. We put him on Lovenox, is a blood thinner, the full nutraceutical bundle, zinc, vitamin C, vitamin D, quercetin. Open the windows. Get that virus aired out there. And he got really sick, as expected. He had dementia. His wishes were to not go to the hospital, not go on a mechanical ventilator. We treated him right there. It took 60 days, and it was a long illness, but he survived. And that was early, and that taught me that if I'm willing to do that for my father, I have a Hippocratic oath, and I have a fiduciary responsibility to my patients, and I refuse to let my patients die of this illness. And when I testified in the U.S. Senate, I told the American people, I have always treated my high-risk patients, always. And at the end of my opening statement, I held up the protocol, and I told the American people, I'm not asking for permission to do this. I'm not, but I'm asking for your help. It's a very, very important statement, because my patients were appropriately treated to the best of my ability. And we have 600,000 dead Americans that were not treated appropriately and not treated to the best of the ability of their doctors. And that will go down in historical shame for our country. I think it is a travesty that we have 600,000 dead Americans. Vast majority of them didn't get an ounce of treatment. In fact, there were medical groups that adopted policies that they weren't going to even answer the calls of COVID-19 patients, and there were millions of patients needlessly hospitalized. We had data that came in later from Dr. Zelenko in New York City, Dr. Proctor here in Dallas, who did the same exact thing, showing that our methods could reduce hospitalization and death by 85%. And I'm sorry, there are no prospective randomized trials of 4 to 6 drugs. There are none planned. So therefore, without any large trials, there are not going to be any guideline statements. And without any guideline statements, we'll never have any agency support for this. But this is about courageous doctors saving Americans. And I would go farther than this. This is about courageous doctors saving the world. So now we have the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. We have FLCC. In the United States, we have 250 treating doctors. We have 4 national telemedicine services, 15 regional telemedicine services. We're treating 10 to 15,000 patients a day. Forget the U.S. government. Forget what anybody says about this. Americans are getting treatment. That once our message on early treatment came with 2 U.S. Senate hearings headed by Senator Ron Johnson, the hospital started clearing out in the end of December, early January. Because early treatment markedly reduces spread and dramatically reduces hospitalization and death. It's the only thing that does that. The hospital doesn't save all the patients. I'd say the hospital honestly has a very modest impact on anything with COVID-19. It's all about early treatment. The hospital started clearing out. The curves came way down in the United States. That's before anybody was fully vaccinated. And I testified in the Texas Senate on March 10th. I said, listen, by standard CDC equations, we're at herd immunity. By March 10th, no vaccine effect. That's actually just treating patients. In Texas, we had 35 treatment centers. Our protocols and methods work. And I have learned over time there are so many ways to treat the virus. I've had a seminar with Dr. Sankaran Chetty in South Africa. He said that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, just like in the United States, had become so politically charged, doctors were losing their license. In fact, some doctors were jailed in trying to help patients with COVID-19. He gave up on them. He's treated 4,000 patients. Fewer than 10% got hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. He treats them. He times the illness. He waits to day 8. And then he starts inhaled and oral steroids. He starts aspirin, other anti-inflammatories, montelukast, and the high-risk patients who uses anticoagulants on the back end. And he saved virtually everyone outside of a handful of patients out of 4,000 sick patients in South Africa. So what I've learned about this virus is if doctors do anything to try to help patients, they can reduce hospitalizations and death. And the only reason why this is such a horrible thing in American history is because doctors fail to act. The U.S. FDA puts out thousands of drug warnings per year. In fact, Americans know this because they see a drug advertised in TV and it says, well, warnings may cause death, may cause what have you. So we get thousands of warnings per year. FDA recalls drugs, put black box warnings on drugs. Doctors still use these drugs. They understand the warnings. About 40% of drugs are used off the advertising label. So once a drug is older, its original advertising label doesn't really apply. So we use drugs, quote, off-label all the time. That's common. But what happened in COVID-19 is because of the tremendous fear that settled in over our country, whatever statements came out by the U.S. FDA, the NIH, and the CDC started to take more weight than they ever would in the past. So if those agencies said something like, don't use hydroxychloroquine, that emanated down through the AMA and H to the pharmacy boards where they actually denied patients hydroxychloroquine. In fact, there are probably patients who died because the pharmacy did not dispense the hydroxychloroquine to patients or the ivermectin. There are doctors who started getting warning letters stating Dr. Richard Urso from Houston and another doctor stepped out of his role like I did to treat the virus, got warning letters from the Texas Medical Board. We're going to examine your license. We understand you're prescribing hydroxychloroquine, trying to help COVID patients. Okay. These doctors, Dr. Robin Armstrong, Dr. Robin Armstrong in Texas saved dozens of nursing home patients with hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, steroids, and blood thinners. The families think he's a hero. The Texas Medical Board tried to take away his license. And so he had to go through hearings and reviews, and ultimately he was restored, although his practice was just damaged, if not destroyed. Emails started coming down through big medical organizations, don't use hydroxychloroquine. They later on came down and said, don't use ivermectin. In fact, there was, flat out, don't do it. We were getting official messages that basically said, don't take care of COVID-19. These are codified in policies and emails by major medical organizations. And it went counter. Can you imagine getting an email saying, don't treat pneumococcal pneumonia, just let him die. Don't treat meningitis, let him die. We've never seen this. The term that applies to what's going on is wrongdoing by those in positions of authority. It's called malfeasance. We don't put down a chilling negative message that's going to result in harm. We don't do that. We don't do that in a civil society. It happened from the NIH, the CDC, the FDA, major medical groups, these chilling messages. But at the same time, you had AAPS saying, no, this is wrong, treat patients. You had FLCC, a group that became very strong, saying, no, treat patients. In the UK, we had the Bird Group that said, you know what, treat patients, use ivermectin-based protocols. We had PANDA develop in South Africa. We had the COVID Medical Network develop in Australia. We had treatment domiciliary develop in Italy. So listen, the counter argument to this of no, we should treat the virus, that counterweight was there. And it's one of the reasons why you're talking to me today. You're not talking to some FDA official who basically wanted to throw cold water on things. You're talking to me today because you're getting a sense of truth. You're getting a sense of reality. That this virus is treatable. Everything that we've done for this virus, we've made it far worse by not treating it, keeping patients in fear, isolation. We've done multiple things that have promoted hospitalization, and we've done multiple things that have actually promoted excess mortality. And it's a shameful time in America and in the world. Under the dark cloud of fear, the medical administrations defer to the FDA, the NIH, and the CDC, our three governmental agencies. They defer to that. In fact, they will state, we're following the policy. So let's pick something less charged, like wearing masks. What sets the mask-wearing policy? What the CDC says. Well, they say this, let's follow it. Same thing is true. If the agencies say, don't use hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, if that's what they say, that quickly gets down to medical administration and they'll float out an email saying, don't do it. In fact, in a country we can pick on it, Australia, they have the TGA. That's the equivalent of the FDA. They have a guidelines where they literally have dozens and dozens of negative statements. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that. Interestingly, none of these groups actually say what to do. So if you were to take any major hospital and ask them, what email or what policy came down that told doctors what to do? You gave warnings on what not to do, but what did you tell them to do to take care of clinic patients with COVID-19? Most of them would say, nothing. We don't have. In fact, I testified in the Texas Senate on this topic, and on March 10th, and within 48 hours, there was draft legislation to at least give patients some information. Say, listen, if the hospitals and doctors aren't going to do anything, we're going to give you some information. When you get your positive test result, here is some information on what you can do. Here are the treatment protocols. Here are the EUA monoclonal antibodies. And again, if hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin is controversial, okay. But what about the monoclonal antibodies? We haven't talked about these. These are high tech. They're produced by big pharma. It's big money. It was all NIH funded. They're emergency use authorized by the US FDA. How come America has no window to that? How come there's no updates on how we're doing with that? How come there's no 1-800 numbers how sick patients can't find out where these antibodies are? So it is a global suppression of early treatment, whether they're generic drugs or newly approved drugs. There is a global suppression on early treatment. Americans will know. They watch the TV every night. The initial dialogue was, we're scared, wear a mask, go in lockdown, hand sanitizer, okay. Then there were some reports about terrible things going in the hospital. Then the reports later on were wait for a vaccine. There were never regular reports or updates from any local or national TV source that gave regular updates. This is what you should do when you get COVID-19 at home. Here are the drugs that work. Here are the protocols. Here are the hotlines so you can get an antibody infusion, which is approved by the FDA. Here are the hotlines so you can get in research. Research is important. There's still no hotline for Americans to get in COVID-19 research at a state or a federal level. Stunning. There's been no updates. When I've dealt with multiple congressional and Senate offices, I said, listen, weekly updates to the American people so they know what to do, so they're not so in fear when they're getting these results. Weekly updates through all public channels, weekly updates on treatment, and then monthly updates to the guidelines. We have none of that. We are over a year of this, and the Americans have been absolutely let down by the government agencies, by the media. The media, why wouldn't it come into any local broadcaster's thought process to give their listeners an update on early treatment? It's a stunning oblivion. For products to actually be officially advertised, they have to have somebody who's going to pay for the ad, which is a drug company, and they have to be FDA approved. And they actually have to have an FDA advertising label. And because of the monoclonal antibodies, as an example, don't have an advertising label, they can't be Lilly and Regeneron can't go out and advertise for them. But because they're EUA, from a public health messaging perspective, they should be equally featured as vaccines. Now, vaccines are emergency use authorized. All we hear about is vaccines morning, noon, and night. Why do we hear a massive messaging about vaccines? Americans ought to think about this. Why are vaccines featured by the CDC, NIH, and FDA morning, noon, and night, by the media morning, noon, and night, by every medical center morning, noon, and night? I can tell you as a doctor in a medical center, all our emails are about vaccination. Why are they featured in every single public health communication, needles in all the arms? In fact, shockingly, in the Dallas area, in October, this is long before the vaccine trials were ever completed, if you were to call CVS or Walgreens, the answering machine would say, we're proud to offer the COVID-19 vaccine when it comes available. We have never advertised for a product before it comes available. In fact, it's against the U.S. laws regarding drugs and biological products. So things started to go off the rails very early on, and it seems like there was a playbook. The playbook was to suppress any hope of treatment, a complete oblivion to treatment through all the entities that we've mentioned, and at the same time, prepare the population for mass vaccination. These two are very tightly linked. And now with mass vaccination, we have see things we have never seen. Advertising the vaccine before it's even available. Massive messaging for the vaccine, far out of proportion to treatment. You have two EUA products. One you never hear about. Americans are starved of these monoclonal antibodies. In fact, they're grossly underused. They could have saved probably tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of lives, and they're being squashed. The Lilly and Regeneron products are being squashed, but the Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J products are being massively promoted and advertised. Americans ought to be kind of wondering, why is that happening? Why are we defocusing on the sick patient and focusing on well people? All the messaging about contagion control and vaccines are about well people. Why can we not focus on the sick COVID patient? That was my message to the Department of Health and Human Services in Texas. But it goes further than that. It goes further than that. The vaccine registrational trials strictly excluded pregnant women, women of childbearing potential, COVID-recovered patients, patients who had prior COVID antibodies, strictly excluded them. By regulatory science, if all the registrational trials excluded a group of patients, we would never use that product in that group once it gets on the market. Never. Never. We never violate that. Why? Because we don't know if it's going to work, and we don't know if it's going to be safe. We never do that. There's another level. With pregnant women, our special group in research and medicinal products. It's very important for Americans to know this. In pregnant women, for vaccination, we only vaccinate with safe, inactive products, inactive flu, tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. That's it. We would never inject a biologically active substance in a pregnant woman's body. That could be dangerous. Never. And with the vaccines, as soon as they came out, the CDC, FDA, media, everybody said, vaccinate them. Vaccinate them. Well, the US FDA regulatory guidance on vaccines, and there have been modern vaccines. You don't have to pick the old ones. I mean, we've had modern vaccines, shingles vaccines, hepatitis B, meningococcal vaccines, demand a minimum of 2 years of safety data. 2 years by regulatory. In fact, these are kind of written and codified into the regulatory rules for the manufacturers. That was all thrown out and said 2 months for COVID. 2 months. So 2 months of observational data. This idea that we could vaccinate people that were not even tested in the trials, that has never been done before. We have never just thrown a vaccine at somebody without having any data. None. So the very first pregnant woman that was vaccinated here in the United States, it was done with no knowledge of safety and no knowledge of efficacy. And the argument that we've heard, is, well, COVID-19 is a bad illness. 600,000 people have died. The vaccine could help them. We should give it a shot. Come on. We should just give it a shot. Well, that 600,000 died. I've already told you 85% of that was preventable with early treatment, which was actively suppressed and squashed. And not only that, is if this vaccine can help them, the vaccine better be safe. It better be safe. And my comments on the vaccine are safety, safety, safety. Let's see it. Let's see it. And Americans ought to, just like the Americans should have been getting weekly updates on treatment innovations, Americans should have been getting weekly updates on vaccine safety. Very important. Weekly updates from our federal officials on safety. Super important. Those two things are probably the two largest acts of malfeasance in all of medical regulatory history. It will go down in history of malfeasance, wrongdoing by those of authority. How come there was no updates on treatment and no promotion of early treatment to reduce hospitalization and death? And now when we release the vaccine, why are there no safety updates? Why are there no attempts for risk mitigation in terms of making the vaccine program safer? How do we have all these vaccines? How do we know that we can vaccinate pregnant women? We know because of years and years and years of safety data. Before a vaccine has ever been injected into a pregnant woman, it's probably been tested for decades before we try it in a pregnant woman. We would never out of the box take a brand new technology that's never been tested before, ever. And we know that the vaccine technology produces the dangerous spike protein. It produced the Wuhan spike protein, the spicule on the ball of the virus itself, which damages blood vessels and causes blood clotting, and all of them do. We would never unleash that into a pregnant woman's body. Americans have to understand something is very wrong what's going on. What's going on now in the world, these are examples, are clear-cut examples of wrongdoing that is at such a high level, the groupthink is in the wrong direction in such a consistent and overwhelming way that people are being harmed in an extraordinary fashion.